All right, we're gonna talk this morning about what I'm gonna call traditional homes or ideal homes, and I hope that I'll be able to present a picture, an ideal picture, how we've departed from that ideal picture, and then in subsequent lessons, I want to talk to about some ways that we can try to recuperate at least the parts of that ideal picture that we need most. Let's turn, first of all, I want to revisit an idea. If you will, turn to Hebrews chapter 12. I mentioned yesterday about the firstborn, traditions of the firstborn, and how we can come to think of old traditions as outdated, and that our traditions are almost always, inevitably, an improvement against and over those traditions that we've moved past. In Hebrews chapter 12 and in verse 16, Hebrews 12 and verse 16, it says, that also there be no sexually immoral or godless person like Esau, who sold his own birthright for a single meal. That idea, he's godless or profane, some of your translations will say, because he sold his birthright. Esau thought poorly or thought little of the privileges that come with being a firstborn. And the commentary on that is that this man is profane because he did not appreciate the value of that. I want to suggest to you that as we look back at these traditions that are really throughout most of human history, only in recent history have we made departures from so many of these traditions. We look at almost all of human history and we go, oh, backwater, you know, they're not as enlightened as we are. That is profane, to look so down our noses at men and women of God throughout the ages and assume they just didn't know as well as we do. It's a bad way of looking at history, especially biblical history. So, for instance, someone will say, oh man, I am just so glad, I thank God that we don't have arranged marriages anymore. I do see, if somebody says, don't you see the pitfalls or the dangers of arranged marriages? Sure. Don't you see the dangers of not arranging them? What happens is people go, you know, when we had arranged marriages, then what ended up happening is men and women, and especially women, were forced into marriages that were loveless, that didn't have all the... And it's like, oh yes, thank God we fixed that. And we don't have loveless marriages and broken homes anymore. Woo! We came up with a solution. You know, or whatever it is that we've moved past. And, you know, people talk about servants and slaves. Oh, we've figured out that that was immoral. And we've moved past that. And now, yes, we treat everybody with dignity. And employers are good to their employees. And employees work well for their employees. There's no animosity anymore. I'm glad we solved that problem. Aren't we so enlightened and smart? We're not. And we don't know better than our forefathers. We are not more enlightened than Abraham. We don't know better, certainly, than Jesus. And so as we look back to these old traditions from Scripture, we need to look back humbly, recognizing we have much to learn. Or, let me say, to relearn. Because all of these things, that's one of the biggest misnomers, is that we've learned better. No, we have forgotten more than we've learned. And we've set down more than we've picked up. So, we want to appreciate the traditions. Well, with that in mind, let's talk about the traditional home. Look over at Ephesians chapter 2. In Ephesians chapter 2, The book of Ephesians is full of the language of home. And I want to look at one place in particular where that word is used and can be seen in the English language. And that is in Ephesians 2 and verse 19, where he says, "So then you are no longer strangers and sojourners, but you are fellow citizens with the saints and are of God's household." All right. Now, I brought some yogurt up here that's Oikos yogurt. This is, it had the name McDaniel on it, so I can only assume that Marshall's like, "I want even my yogurt to be Greek," you know. But, yeah, right. So, Oikos. This is the word in Ephesians 2:19 for household, or at least it's the root word there for God's household. Now, why do you suppose they would put that word on here? Yeah, yeah. What did somebody else say that don't know what it means? No, I think they do. It's Greek yogurt. Let's see. I was going to look and see where it was manufactured there in the, yes, that Greek colony of the White Plains, New York. I think the idea is like, you know, when you want to conjure up something wholesome, right, you say it's home, right? Homemade or things like that. So I think that's the idea, you know, that they're trying to propagate there. But oikos is this word here in Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 19, God's household. And the idea is that you have come into a place of privilege and a place of blessings, and especially that you've come into a place of privilege and blessing that you did not have before. There's a connection here, as you look in verse 19, between the word sojourners and household. I think there's also a likely connection between strangers and citizens, right? So strangers is that word xenos. That's where we get our word xenophobia, right? Fear of strangers. So that's the word for strangers. And I think that that is contrasted with citizens, right? You're non-citizens, now you are citizens. And then the word sojourners, even tighter connection, the word there is para. Oikos, or, you know, I mean, it would be those two words combined, right? You got the prefix para, and then you've got oikos, which is like if we say there's a paramilitary group. They are not the military, right? They are outside, maybe they come alongside, but they're not a part of. They're not the same thing. So sojourners would be somebody who is, like back in Israel's history, they are people who traveled alongside Israel. They may have even had a lot of the blessings that go along with living among Israel, but they are not Israel. They stay sojourners. No longer. The para-oikos has become part of the oikos, right? And so that they would understand that maybe a little bit more than we do, what it means to be outside of the household and now to really be a part of the household. But our question is, what does that mean? What images does that and should that conjure up? When a first century citizen, when a reader of this letter of Ephesians read that word, "You're part of God's oikos," what did they hear? So let's start here. How would you describe, what are the elements of an ideal household? Yes, sir.
Regarding the name householder, familial.
Okay.
We're family.
Yeah.
And second, householder has its origins as a steward.
Mm-hmm.
A steward. So if we properly see ourselves as fellow family members, brethren, and that we are stewards not only of God's word, but going on in that house, not just in worship, but in that congregational order, assembly
term. Okay. Yes, we're going to get to all of that. Bring it back down to right here. If somebody said, they want to present a picture, in very practical terms, what does an ideal house, what all is there? What would you see when you walked into, in physical terms, right here? All right, mother, father, child. Okay, fair enough. What else?
Happiness,
love. Okay, good. What else? Unity, protection,
correction.
Fireplace and candles. Comfortable. The what now?
Where we're comfortable.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. Pardon?
Animals.
Yeah. Do you think animals would be a part of the ideal household? I mean, do you think? Huh? No? Okay. Huh? Do you think an ideal home would have that extended family?
It seemed to be that way.
I do. I'm just...
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Depends on the mother-in-law.
Yeah.
The older we get, we're more thinking that way.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think I heard a statistic like only 30-something percent of... people under the age of 30 think that it is the responsibility of children to take care of their parents. Incidentally, 70-something percent of people over 60 think it is the responsibility of their children to take care of their parents. Hmm.
We're looking
for the in-laws. That's right. What else?
Provision.
Hmm?
Provision and feeding.
Yeah. What else? Grandparents. Yeah, that's in-laws, you know. What else? Safety. What are people doing? Yeah, yeah. Rick brought that right. So that's home is where the heart is, right? All right. Yeah, work industry. What do you think in the ideal home? What do you think the dad's doing? Where? Where does he labor?
On his land.
Uh huh. Yeah. Yeah. At home. What's mom doing? Laboring alongside dad at home. What are the kids doing? Laboring alongside mom and dad at home. What else is happening at home? Yeah, lots of laboring. Right? That's right. God's word is the centerpiece of that home. I think that usually if we're thinking of an ideal home, we have reduced it far down, we've downgraded it and shipped out a lot of what of should be there. So for instance, when somebody says animals is part of the ideal home, I think most people would have thought that that was a correct answer for most of history. I think only recently we've gotten to the point where like, well, no, I mean, that doesn't have to be there. Well, it doesn't have to be there. But most people would have thought it should be there. They would have thought you need some land, that you need some things growing on that land. They would have thought that, yes, generations would be there, right? It wouldn't be just a what we call a nuclear family of mother, father, child. No, there's going to be probably a dozen children there because in fact, we need those too. And so all of these aspects would have been normal aspects. But what's become normal for us today is a middle-class suburban McMansion cookie cutter with a manicured lawn that we pull in our car to our garage. We don't even know who our neighbors are. And our lives are so truncated and compartmentalized and not lived together. So I want to think about that. I want to think about what this looked like and what's been lost. It doesn't mean that privilege doesn't mean coming into a 20th century or 21st century middle class American home. That is not what the word household means. That is not the privileges of the household. You know, I thought Navitesh came here a few years ago in 2019, I think, and he stayed with us at my house for about a week before we came up here. And I'll just say, you know, Ken and I talked about it before he came, that there would be a certain amount of culture shock, that what he would see is house after house after house, just everybody living in such a more prosperous lifestyle than what he was used to. And there's some concern there. What's that going to look? What's that going to communicate? Navitesh was very humble about that, and he said something that almost made me ashamed. He said, "You know, I now am understanding what you live in every day, and it just makes me so much more thankful that you're willing to walk away from this for a month to come be with us." And I thought, oh, it's nothing. It's nothing for me to walk away from that for a month. And I'll tell you what, I see things in Fiji, I see things in the homes in Fiji that we have lost. And that I love to go see and be a part of. I see when I go to Fiji that when Nevitesh's mother was in need of a home, he put a curtain down the middle of his daughter's room, and they sleep on this side and she sleeps on that side of the curtain. And when we were building a house and had to move into my parents' house for a little while, and my daughters were like, our rooms are not as big as they used to be. I have good daughters. I don't want you to have an impression that they're just materialistic, eat up with it. But what they are is used to comfort. They're used to first world problems. And they don't understand the privileges of a household as well as I would like them to. I don't understand the privileges of a household as well as I would like to.
I don't want to use your time, but just I was thinking about it when you're talking about the family,
yes,
the nuclear family, and you take the families in Fiji, and one that sticks out, and they're all this way, is Munil,
yes,
and his family. And so Munil, the younger man in his mid-30s, lives with his parents. That's the way it works. He has his own. When he gets married, the wife will come and live with them in that home. And then the mother and father are taking care of her mother and his mother before she passed away. And if you tried to take her away, she's 90-something years old, and put her in a nursing home, they would fight you.
Yes.
You know, it's their honor. They view it as an honor to take,
yes,
care of the mother.
Which is something we'll come back to, is that whole notion of honor and talk about how that was talked about in the first century.
And they treat her with such respect.
Yes. Yeah. Did somebody else? Yeah.
So it's good for the 33-year-old son to stay home in the basement.
It is not. It is not. It is, you know, I'll tell you this. The problem is not that he's at home. The problem is doing nothing.
Exactly.
And I think we think, that's right, Munil's making more money than his parents. He's supporting them, right? So the difference is when people say, you know, he should go out and he should strike out in life. No, he should go do something. That's the problem. He should be an asset to his parents and not a drain, which that's what we'll be talking about more. Okay, let's look at this oikos word in the book of Ephesians in a couple of other places. Go back to Ephesians chapter 1 and verse 10. Ephesians chapter 1 and verse 10. Somebody with I think the New King James. Yeah, John, read that for us.
1 verse 10.
Yep.
That in the dispensation of the fullness of the times, he might gather together in one all things, in
All right. So the dispensation of the fullness of times. In the LSB, it says for an administration of the fullness of times. Anybody got the stewardship? Not sure if there are any translations that have that. It is over in chapter 3 and verse 2. If indeed you have heard of the stewardship of God's grace, which was given to me for you. This word has one of the roots here is the word oikos. All right? So we've got that word home. And you look in Ephesians 1 and verse 10, and it's hard to figure out how home is a part of what's being talked about there, the administration of the fullness of time. Or even over in chapter 3 and verse 2, the stewardship of God's grace which was given to me. What does this have to do with home? So one thing I would just say is here again is a vocabulary word that we've lost some connection with. When is the last time you asked somebody, what do you do? And they go, oh, I'm a steward. You ever had anybody come back with that response? No, this is not a position that exists essentially in our day and age. And so we kind of have to go do some recovery work, right? Like we can't just say, oh, this, you know what stewards do. No, you don't. I mean, we can't look around and see that. But the idea is oikonomos, which if you take that into English, oiko you can turn into eco, right? That's how we translate that as a prefix today. So eco, what are we describing when we use the prefix eco? Huh? Okay, well, oikonomos is going to be economics, and we'll get there in just a minute. An ecosystem, right? Do what? Ecology. What's the eco part of that referring to? Systems that work together, how this operates and so forth, how things connect with each other. It's the way things work. That's the home, right? Your home is your ecosystem. It's how the home operates. Now, eco-nomos, the nomos there is rule. So it's house rules. What is the order of the home? How does the home operate? And so in that vein, this word is used in this way in Ephesians 1 and verse 10. For the house rule, or rather God's, in God's order, in the fullness of time. Or in the case of Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 2, that by revelation, if indeed you have heard of the stewardship of God's grace, this house order that God handed over to Paul to accomplish. The word administration, I think, can be helpful here. When you think about the word administration, what comes to mind? Management, all right. What about if I put a definite article? The administration. Yeah, political or educational, right? And so usually when we say the administration, we're talking about an institution, an organization, or maybe even a presidency with an agenda. They have something they want to accomplish. Are you on board with this administration? Or are you fighting against this administration? I think that really is how the word's being used in the New Testament, right? Are you helping this administration or are you trying to block this administration? That would be terminology you would hear. And I think that's the idea is are you furthering God's purposes or are you acting against? Of course, Paul is furthering God's purposes. Over in 1 Timothy chapter 4, chapter 1 and verse 4, it says, nor pay attention to myths and endless genealogies which give rise to mere speculation, rather than furthering the stewardship or the administration from God which is by faith. So here, what he's saying is don't do things, don't get caught up in things that actually hinder the administration of God, the purposes, the agenda. You rather focus on things that are going to further that agenda, right? That are going to help and aid and spread that agenda. These things, these myths and genealogies, they get in the way. All right, so thinking about that from the standpoint of the home as an administration, as an economy, an oikos nomos, what is the agenda of the home? What is the administration of the home? When we think about the word economy, what does that refer to? When somebody says, oh, the economy, huh?
Buying and selling, trade.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's it, right? Financial dealings, right? The buying and selling and trading of goods and services, even. And maybe we think about that on a small scale, microeconomics. Maybe we think about that on a national scale, macroeconomics, or a world scale. But it's always tied to finances. Now, that's an evolution of the term. The term was much more thorough in this time, that it refers to everything that's going on. Yes, including what we would call economic activity, but that would include, you know, just the daily functioning of a home. So economics on a national scale would refer to not just the financial aspects of a nation, but everything, the legal codes, the ways that nations deal with each other, the treaties and so forth, all of that would be the economy of a nation. So the economy of a home is just how that home operates and what that home is trying to accomplish. Now, having said that, even in our modern sense of the word economy, the home was the center of economy. In all of most of human history. That is to say that we didn't have Walmart or anything like it. People produced, consumed, made the goods, and maybe sold some goods all at home. They didn't go somewhere to have those things produced for the most part. Even well on into modern era, you still have homes that were producing most of what they consumed and buying maybe things that could, the few things that could not be produced on the land. And it wasn't till the Industrial Revolution, which we'll talk about in a minute, be very exciting, I promise you. It wasn't until that time that that shifted away from the home. So the home was the center of economic activity. Now, in Proverbs chapter 31, you can see that, can't you? You know, we read Proverbs 31 with a modern eye. It says of the woman, beginning in verse 13, she searches for wool and flax and works with her hands in delight. She is like merchant ships. She brings her food from afar. And she rises while it is still night and gives food to her household and a portion to her young women. And she makes plans for a field and buys it. From the fruit of her hand, she plants a vineyard. She girds herself with strength and makes her arms strong. And she senses that her gain is good and her lamp does not go out at night. And she stretches out her hands to the distaff, and her hands hold fast the spindle. She extends her hand to the poor, and she stretches out her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of the snow for her household, for all her household are clothed with scarlet. She makes coverings for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. All of this activity, and people go back and say, see, she's a real estate agent. Oh, what are you talking about? That doesn't exist. You're thinking in modern terms. Here is a woman who understands the administration. And she is on board with the administration. And she is working tirelessly to forward the administration's goals. Right? She is side by side with her husband. And she is working in such a way that, he, that representative of the oikos, is honored because of all of her activity. But then we go, well, there's permission to get her face on a billboard and sell houses. What are you talking? You're having a completely different conversation than what is being written here in Proverbs 31. Well, when we think about who all is there and what all was happening there, it's where life was lived. We spend most of our time outside of our homes, typically, today. We spend more time away, living more life away from home than in the home. The husbands, our work is away from home. The children go to school away from home. Mom maybe stays home, but usually by now she's got a career away from home. And then we come home at night and we make usage of the home about like we do a hotel. And we sit down and we get some food and we go to sleep so that we can get up and go live life somewhere else. And at best, we are gathering around the same table to talk about the very different lives we are living. That's not how it would have gone then. The whole economy would have been at home. And when everybody sat down to the table, as they would be talking about all the things they were doing together, not all the things they were doing separately. So I'm not against having those meals around the table. And I'm not even going to tell you that we have to get back to the point, that we have to get back to the point where we're all working at home. But I do want to suggest this. We lost something when we lost that. We lost something good when we lost that. And it is something that we have to deal with the cost of. But first of all, we have to even recognize what the cost is. One of the things that happened along the way is we began to think of the pieces and parts of the household as individuals. In Matthew chapter 18 and verse 25, now I don't mean that there's no sense in which members of the household were individuals then, but not so radically as they are now. Households were a unit. You know, you thought of everybody in that household as part of the same piece. Oikos referred, incidentally, not just to the people, but even the property. It was all mixed up in the same notion. You couldn't separate somebody's identity from the household that they were a part of, not completely. In Matthew chapter 18 and verse 25, you get some sense of that in a very negative way. It says, with regard to the servant, this is the parable of the servant who's forgiven by his master. It says in verse 25, since the slave, he did not have the means to repay, his Lord commanded him to be sold along with his wife and children and all that he had, and repayment be made. What did they do? They're part of the household. And when one member of the household gets into debt, then the household gets into debt. You see, they didn't have limited liability corporations to shield them from the consequences of bad behavior. They didn't have these distinctions. Say, well, now, I didn't sign on that dotted line. Yeah, but your son did. Or your father did. And again, that would have been a thing that, continued on through the 19th century. You know, you read Charles Dickens or read about his life, and his father was an imprudent man with finances, and he and his family got thrown into debtor's prison. Now, you might say, yeah, I think that's pretty rough. I think it is rough. But I think if we look at that and all we say is we need to throw that in the trash bin. And we don't recognize why it was a good thing for the home to be recognized as a unit, then we are missing some things. There was value in everybody being invested in the home in a way that says, whatever happens to this home happens to all of us. And we are all here to suffer the consequences and to gain the honor that goes along with being a part of this household. People are still willing to gain the honor. They're still willing to enjoy whatever honor comes along from being a part of a household where maybe the father has success, but they have sat down and said, but we don't want the shame. You see, it goes hand in hand. And I think we need to appreciate that, that children, you know, some people say that you shouldn't say to your children, like preachers, you put a lot of pressure on your children when you say, you got to remember that I preach here. And my reputation is part of the consideration about what you do. Oh, don't put that pressure on children. Why not? They are part of this household. My daughter asked me one time about a Bible class, an evening ladies' Bible class at Pepper Road, and she said, are you okay if I wear pants to this Bible study? And I said, well, let me tell you two things. Number one, you know that I don't make a dress code about what people wear to a Bible study like that, especially. But number two, when you look around that room, I want you to recognize that what you do is not just a choice about you, but it is about our family. And so I'm going to allow you some room to make this decision, but I want you to think about all the implications of the decision and not just for you. So she put on a skirt. Now, you may not agree with that decision or whatever, and I don't frankly care. My point is that I think it's perfectly appropriate to tell our children that their decisions involve more than just them and to put the pressures of the household onto our children. And vice versa, to take those pressures as parents and say, I know what I do is going to affect my children and my reputation is going to affect them as well. This is part of the acceptance of being part of the household. That's what happens when we come into God's household, right? We share the honor. Guess what? We also share the shame of the cross. We don't distance ourselves and say, well, look, now I'm not, you know, like Peter, I'm not on board with that part. I want all the privileges of being at the right hand of God, but I want none of the shame that comes along with taking that position. No, we share in God's household, we share in the honor and we share in the shame because we have come in to be a part of his household. It is privilege and it is also a great deal of responsibility. One of the things that's happened is that we have lost a lot of the natural reasons, pressures, the natural motivations for traditional arrangements of the home. What do I mean by that? Well, let's see. let me think. Ken, you weren't a Christian when you got married, right? Or were you? Okay, about a month as a Christian. Why did you want to get married? Yeah.
I married up,
buddy. Yeah. But seriously, I mean, thinking through that, what are your motivations at that point? I love her. Want to spend my life with her. Absolutely. Any guy asking here is probably going to come up with a similar answer, right? I looked at her. I saw her. She was beautiful. That's right. It was love at first sight, or maybe even it wasn't love at first sight, but I fell in love with her. In the Christmas Carol, you remember when Scrooge's nephew comes in invites him over for Christmas dinner, and Scrooge is, you know, dismissive of him. And he says, I've married, and I want you to come and meet my wife. And he says, you got married? Why did you get married? He says, because I fell in love. And Scrooge's response in the book, I've got a version of Tim Curry reading this, it's perfect. He says, you fell in love. And he says it with scorn and contempt. Like, what a foolish foundation on which to base marriage. And we, like good Western citizens, go, Scrooge, what a rube. He's the real rube. Love, falling in love, this is the greatest thing in life, isn't it? Can I suggest to you that a woman, an average woman in the 1400s in Europe, would have looked at falling in love as a luxury to go along with the more necessary elements of getting married? Why do you think a woman in the 1400s might say she got married? I need someone to take care of me. Yeah, that's right. I need somebody to protect me from a ruthless and savage world. I need someone who I can lean on, who has the strength to hold me up and to protect me from people who would do me harm. It is why that world that leaves women especially and children defenseless is why the Bible repeatedly says, look out for the widows and the orphans, because they need somebody to take care of them. But we fixed all that, didn't we? Now, women don't need protection because we live in a civilized country. That's why the Me Too movement is screaming and saying, what are you going to do about these men? And the women who are screaming about that, saying these men are abusing us, are the very same ones that said we don't need men in our lives anymore. Maybe you got what you asked for. Now, don't hear me wrong. I am not justifying the brutality of men. I am saying that women who did not recognize that men could be brutal and that they would be helpless in the face of that brutality and therefore told good men to get out of their way contributed to a problem of men being brutal, which they always have, and no men's good men standing between the brutal men and the women. God provided for that. And most of history has educated women, even women who didn't believe in God, could just look around and say, yeah, I see the problem and I see a viable solution. I can't go out there. I don't have the physical strength to go out there and break up the ground as needed to even grow food for myself. I need somebody who has denser bone structure and bigger muscles than I do to even be able to eat consistently. But we fixed all that. And we don't need those things anymore. Why do you think husbands got married in the 1400s? Pardon? Yeah. Yeah. I would say that, right? Reproduction, to be fruitful and multiply. And to have an heir and to have, to have workers come alongside and to be a part of what he was building. I think most men thought in terms of, I am trying to accomplish something and I need help. And lo and behold, God made something just for that. Somebody to step right alongside of you and help you in those things. Help you both emotionally and physically, to stand side by side and keep you built up and support you in that. And I think men understood the need for that, to have a partner Men still understand that at some level, like a business partner, but they don't understand because their homes aren't economic activity anymore. Now it's been reduced to, I'm just kind of lonely. Loneliness is something that marriage solves. And I think it's something marriage is intended to solve, but it wasn't the thing marriage intended to solve. Is that marriage was in order to do something. That's why I asked the question yesterday. What's a family for? Right? And then usually our answers go to happiness and satisfaction. And no, families are meant to build things. To build substantive things. To build our own little empires, our domains over which we exercise dominion. That's God's original, right, mandate to man and woman to exercise dominion over the earth. And he doesn't mean, you know, take over the world. He means you're a little part of it. Exercise dominion over your domain. We don't even have domains anymore. We go help somebody else exercise dominion over their domain while they're making it bigger and bigger, and we're at home just taking what's left over. I don't think that's the picture. At least it's not the ideal picture of what God has in mind here. Yep.
Just real quick. The word edify is built on this word.
Yes. Yeah, edification, which we'll talk more about as we talk about piety, some other things. Children, the purpose of children. You ask people why they have children today. Why do you think most people have children today? All right, one reason is because they choose to, or they don't have self-control. Well, I got a little baby at the house right now who's one of five that a woman who is 24 has produced and is in rehab right now, and she just doesn't have self-control. You know, it's not that she wants more babies. She just won't live a sexually pure life. But when people are living sexually pure lives or have come into marriage, then now we've made children into sort of this like optional adornment, an optional decoration to the home that we have. But we don't see them as necessary, right? As something that we need to have heirs. Now, what all would have been the necessary, the natural motivations that would have pushed people to have children in history? Yeah, number one is just like, look, I mean, on a farm, you say, why'd they have 12 children? Have you tried to pull a plow behind a mule? Like, you can only do that so long. You need somebody else to pick that up at some point. Huh? Heritage, inheritance. I'm building all this up, and then what am I going to do with it? I want somebody to take this and keep going and do more with it. Right? That mentality of generational, building something that is of generational impact. We have lost connection with our generations. I read the story of the Rechabites in Jeremiah chapter 35. And they are told, or Jeremiah brings them up, points to them and says, here are people who are sticking steadfastly to the words of an ancestor 200 years ago, I think it's maybe 130, but 130 years ago, who said something, who laid down some institutes, and they're still following it. Do you even know who your ancestors were 130 years ago? I know their names because I've done some genealogy, right? That's what I know. I know that my sixth great-grandfather hated the Mormons because he put it on a plaque in Morgan County, Alabama. But I don't know them. The people, when God came to Moses, I am the God of who? Your fathers. That's who I am. I think if people came and said, I am something connected to your great-great-great-great-grandfather, we'd be like, okay. What does that have to do with me? But people didn't feel that then. We're not rooted people anymore. We don't have roots. People used to. Somebody was writing a book about these sorts of things, and he's talking about being rooted, talking about southern life and farm life, particularly rural life. And he said, people were rooted. And he said, by rooted, I mean you know what your great-grandmother's maiden name was. You didn't just know who they were. You know what their maiden name was. Like, you know the family history and the family lore. We just don't tell stories like that anymore. I think about that. My granddad at one point, not too many years ago, we were riding around Belgrade. He said, hey, turn right here. I just turned off, and we start going through these country roads. He says, stop. I pull up a little bit more. He says, all right, right there is the first house we lived in that I remember. And it was a dirt floor. We were sharecroppers. And he says, now, go up the road here just a little bit, turn right. He stopped and he says, we moved when I was 8 into this house. And we did because this farmer had a tractor, and it made my dad's work a little bit easier. Now, come over here, and we drove down the road a little bit more. He said, then we moved here. He said, he didn't have a tractor. We went back to using mules, but he gave Dad a little bit better share of the profits of the farm. And as he took me through one place after another, I realized, I don't know this man as well as I want to. Why don't I know this stuff? Because we don't think that's important anymore. To know who our ancestors are. So that somebody could say, I am the God of your fathers, and that means I better listen to what this God has to say. Because I care who my fathers are. I think culturally we've dismissed that till now, hopefully, maybe, barely, we have a relationship with our grandparents. But nothing past that. Well, along with that, and an inheritance and everything else, workers, can you think of any other reasons for children? Absolutely. Absolutely. Phyllis Schlafly, when she was fighting back against the Equal Rights Amendment, which sounds like a great thing, right? In the 1970s, it was equal rights for women. And what it really was, and what she was saying, is it made women equal to men in a way that they never should be and should never want to be. In other words, opened up the possibility of women going in the draft. It opened up responsibilities for women that really ought to be put on men. So anyway, she's fighting back against that. And she wrote several articles. And one of the articles that she wrote was about the purpose of children. And one of the things she said is, you know, somehow people through most of history got along without Social Security. It was called having children and raising them right. And so you didn't need Social Security because you knew, I got good kids. I know they'll do what they're supposed to do, and they will take care of me. And especially, you probably had a lot of them. You know, you think about that now, you have a couple of kids, and it really is kind of a burden when we get older and infirmed, and we need lots of care. And so your two children are having to divide that labor. Imagine you got 12 kids. I'm going to tell you what, with 1/12 of your income, you can spare pretty easily 1/12 of your income to continue to support your parents in their old age till they don't even need it. You are their retirement plan, right? They don't have to put away the money and save up in 401ks and hope that the stock market doesn't crash. You're their security in their old age. But we fixed that, didn't we? Because we got Social Security, and that'll never fail. See, in so many ways, we think we fixed the problems, but we haven't. We are less secure and on more shaky ground than we ever were. All right. How did we get here? Well, that's where we're going to break, actually. We'll take about 5 minutes, and just after the top of the hour, we'll come back and talk about how we got to where we are.